Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything, and lots of folks on the line, so we've got a great hour coming up this hour. And when Jimmy's here, Ask Me Anything means anything, so if you've got a question, get in the queue, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I don't know, I was a kid, growing up here in America, nobody ever said Q when I was a kid. I don't even think I knew what a Q was till I was like 25 years old. Were you exposed to the word Q, Jimmy, as a child?
Yeah.
You were?
Well, as
I missed it.
I don't remember when I mean, Q has several meanings that I was aware of as a young person. It can refer to a line.
Yeah.
You know, getting in a queue. It can refer to a kind of braided piece of hair.
Oh, really?
In a person who may have otherwise shaved their head, but if they've got like a single braid, let's say they're otherwise bald, but they've got a single braid, that's a queue.
Oh. Pool. That might be spelled differently, though. I don't know.
That's spelled with a C.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a homophone. It sounds the same.
Right.
And so,
if somebody had said to me as a child, get in a queue, I would not have known what they were talking about. But also, I was the kid that the teacher said I could go to the, or she was explaining to me when the first day of school where the lavatory was, and I had no idea what that meant. I thought, I like many people, I thought that there was like a lab. Like I was like, oh, cool. We're going to do experiments and stuff. I had never heard that term. Was I a particularly dumb kid? I don't know.
I would have thought a lavatory has something to do with volcanoes.
Oh, yeah. That's right. The lavatory. That's a lavatory.
The queue, the use of queue to mean line, that's more of a British usage than an American usage, but it's become more well known in recent decades in American English, is my impression.
Yeah right. All right, back to the phones we go. Greg is in central Montana watching on YouTube. Thanks for waiting in the queue. Greg, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi there, fellas. I had a question about if you were in like a Groundhog Day scenario, what does your obligation to attend Mass look like? I understand, like, the Sunday Mass attendance, obviously, but if you're in the same-day loop, what does that look like, and does it look different if it's a Sunday or, like, a weekday?
Okay. So we're in a one-day loop, is that correct? A 24-hour loop.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this all month with the Bill Murray Groundhog Day,
right?
Loops, and
so if it's a 1 day loop and it's a midnight to midnight loop, is that correct? It doesn't cross a day boundary.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. Well, if it's a weekday, 1 day, 24-hour loop. So let's say you just keep repeating Wednesday over and over again, then you wouldn't have a Mass obligation as long as you're in that loop, because according to the because you're never on a day that has a Sunday obligation attached to it, unless you know it happens to be a holy day of obligation other than Sunday, but we'll assume that's not the case. If you are on a day that has a holy day of obligation, which includes Sundays, then in principle, you would think that you have the obligation to go to Mass every time the loop repeats. But there could be reason to question that, because canon law is not really designed to work in this kind of situation. And there are provisions in canon law for people who are in special circumstances especially travelers, to not have the same kind of Sunday obligations that otherwise would exist. Like, for example, there's a whole apostolate that the Vatican has known as the Apostolate of the Sea that deals with maritime workers and travelers who may be on board a ship on a Sunday, and they just don't have a Sunday obligation that they have to fulfill, even though it's a Sunday. And if you can say, okay, well, these kind of travelers, these mariners, if they don't have a Sunday obligation, then, and you can think of parallel situations where, like, someone's on the International Space Station, but that orbits the Earth every 45 minutes, you know, so they're gonna, it would just be impractical, even if they had mass available on the International Space Station. It would just be impractical to do it every 45 minutes or every seventh 45-minute period. So that's another situation where travelers would have kind of an exemption. And if travelers in space, whether that's on the surface of the ocean or flying through the air or orbiting the Earth, have an exemption, then I could argue by parallel reason and canonically that time travelers are going to have an exemption as well. And so just like it would, because the church is not trying to ask people to go to mass rigidly, you know, like if you were literally repeating the same 24 hours over and over again, I don't think the legislator would expect you to have an obligation every single time you repeat that same Sunday. And so I would suspect that you could argue canonically that there's going to be a time traveler exemption for anyone who's stuck in a loop like that. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't go to mass when you can, but I would suspect you just don't have an obligation. On the other hand, there may be other factors that, that would lead you to want to go to church, every day, every time you repeat that 24-hour Sunday loop, because Bill Murray in that movie, even though he's not in the Blues Brothers in that movie, it's like Cab Calloway tells Jake and Elwood, you guys need some churching up. And that's ultimately what Bill Murray needs in Groundhog Day. He needs to get his priorities straight. He needs some churching up. And so if he was stuck in a Sunday in Groundhog Day, I would say, actually, I would advise you to go to church anyway. You don't want to disturb the timeline unduly, and you want to get to the point spiritually where you can get out of this trap. And one of the best ways of doing that is getting right with the Lord.
What do you think, Greg?
Yeah, I appreciate it. I've been thinking about this since the second of the month and waiting for time to talk to Jimmy.
This seems like a very good way to spend your time, Greg.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you taking my call.
Thank you very much. All right, let's go. Yeah, let's do another one. Linda in Ohio, listening on Annunciation Radio. Linda, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
My question is about a comment made by an author on another Catholic radio program this morning.
I didn't hear it, so I can't comment on it. But I can answer that.
Yeah, the question is, the statement was made about this book she wrote for the Bible for Lent and Easter. I'm not going to say her name because I just don't want to do that. But
well, you could just ask the question if you'd like.
What's the question?
Just give Jimmy the question and we'll get you
the
answer.
Okay, the question is, she said the Mass, that this book is so much better than the Mass because the Mass is just jumping around in the Bible.
Okay.
And I don't see that at all. We don't jump around.
So your question is, Jimmy, do we jump around or not?
Yes.
Okay, Jimmy.
Why would anyone say that?
Okay. Well, okay, Linda, you're going to ask, I don't know who this author is. I don't know what their book is. I don't know how it is or isn't similar to the Mass. I don't know what she said. If she said what you report she said, well, you'd have to ask her why she would say something like that. I can't read her heart. I don't even know who she is. So you'd have to ask her, why would you say that? In terms of if the question is, do we jump around at Mass in the scripture readings? Well, it's going to depend on what you mean by jump around. You know, there is if you read the church's liturgical documents, there is, and particularly connected with the readings at Mass, there are semi-continuous readings across a period of days where you're largely following one book in roughly sequential order during a stretch of days. But then there will be a discontinuity and we'll jump to something else. Or there will be a special day where, in order to commemorate a particular thing, we'll deviate from the semi-continuous reading that we've been doing to hit something special for this day. So there's an element of jumping around, but there's an element of not jumping around. So, you know, if she was seriously saying her book is superior to the readings in the liturgy, well, I didn't hear what she said. She may have meant for some particular purpose, her book is going to give you benefits that the scripture readings won't. And well, that can be true. Just like sitting down and reading the Bible can give you benefits that you won't get from just confining yourself to the scripture readings at Mass. We're not meant to encounter the Bible in only one way. We're meant to encounter the Bible in a bunch of different ways. One of them is the scripture readings at Mass, but private reading, group Bible study, specially themed devotional reading, all of these have a role in the Christian life. And so I would just have to know more about what she did or didn't say in order to comment. But I don't think that there is one privileged way of accessing the Bible to the exclusion of all the other ways, and they can each have their benefits and they can each offer something to contribute to the Christian life.
Linda, I'm going to say thank you because we've got to go to the break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
EWTN Radio Essentials is now EWTN Radio Extra. It's the past, present, and future of Catholic radio. You'll hear classic programs from Mother Angelica and Dr. Scott Hahn, plus timeless devotionals and award-winning podcasts from our partners on EWTN's Podcast Central. Listen now to EWTN Radio Extra on the EWTN app, on smart speakers, and on EWTN.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, all the lines full. So back to the phones we go. Lad is in Smyrna, Tennessee, home of Polycarp, watching on YouTube. Lad, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead with your question.
Oh, thanks, Si. And I appreciate you taking the call.
Oh, we're happy to
I
have
you. I wanted to say I'm not Catholic yet. I'm in OCIA and will be coming in at the Easter Vigil.
Beautiful. Congratulations.
Okay. Congratulations.
It's been a... Well, thank you. Thank you. And Jimmy has been very helpful through his books. I have three of them.
And, very good.
But I love history, and my question is there anything, any documents that tell the difference between, like, the titles of cardinal and bishop and archbishop and how they come about those positions?
Okay, well, so the fundamental difference is between, read along one axis of the question, is between a bishop and an archbishop. And the difference is that a bishop is the head of an ordinary diocese, and an archbishop is the head of an archdiocese. Arche is Greek. It means first or chief. And so an archdiocese is a chief diocese. It's a diocese that has more historical and religious prestige than other dioceses. It also may have a special function among the diocese in a particular territory. But like, for example, Baltimore was the first diocese in the United States. And so today, because of its historical importance, it's the Archdiocese of Baltimore. And so it has an archbishop. But functionally, in terms of the sacrament, there's no difference between a bishop and an archbishop. It's just they have the title based on what kind of diocese they're assigned to. A cardinal is something else. It's derived from the Latin, the word cardinal is derived from the Latin word for hinge. And so there were, over in Rome, historically, there were individuals, advisors to the Bishop of Rome, who were like, oh, these are the key guys. These are the hinge guys. Everything turns on them. They're the Pope's close advisors. And so they became known as cardinals. And today, almost all cardinals are bishops or archbishops, but they're almost always a bishop. There are occasionally a few exceptions for priests who are asked to become cardinals, typically because of their theological contributions. Like an example was the Jesuit Avery Dulles a few years ago. He was a priest. He was a genius theologian. He made a lot of contributions theologically, and he was asked to become by John Paul II to become cardinal. But being a Jesuit, he didn't want to become a bishop. And so he said, I'm very honored. I would, you know, love to accept your invitation to be a cardinal, but may I please just stay an ordinary priest? And he was granted permission to do that. Another example of the same thing was Cardinal John Henry Newman. He was a British priest who was allowed to remain a priest, even though he was elevated to becoming a cardinal, meaning he was an advisor, a principal advisor to the Pope. Cardinals also have legal, the fancy word is titular. They have titular assignments in Rome. So that means they're legally, members of the Roman clergy. So when they elect a new pope, it's technically the members of the Roman clergy who are electing the new pope, even if they aren't from Rome and they don't spend hardly any of their time in Rome. They're from all over the world, but they will still have a parish assignment in Rome as part of their office as cardinals. So they will have a church in Rome that when they do go there, this is a church where they have a special tie to Rome and ministry in Rome. Historically, there have also been others who have been members of the College of Cardinals who were not even ordained. There have been laymen who were cardinals, but that hadn't been the case for some time now. And these days, you don't get appointed to the College of Cardinals unless you're at least a priest and normally a bishop.
Does that do what you needed? Does that answer what you wanted?
Yeah, that helps tremendously. Thank you so much. And I just wanted to say I'm enjoying the OCIA, and it's not like I heard from your experience that you had
where
it's quite different.
But yeah,
we have
well,
a very
I was
good class, and we've got 48.
Oh, wow, right. That's great news.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I help out with my local parish's OCIA, and it's worlds different than it was when I came into the church. We didn't even have the Catechism of the Catholic Church then, and the publication of that has really improved the quality of catechesis. By the way, lad, out of curiosity, was your mother's maiden name Lad?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
My great mm-hmm. uncle's name was Lad, his first name, so it's a family name.
Yep. Okay.
Gotcha.
Just curious. Thank you.
Well, Lad, it was a great pleasure talking with you. I hope we'll get to speak with you again. And I'm very glad to hear that it was Jimmy Akin's books were so helpful. And if you would, give us a call back after Easter. It would be wonderful to hear how things went. And maybe you could have a follow-up question for Jimmy about what you encountered in that, in the coming into the church or about anything in the Catholic Church. But God bless you and thank you for the call. Gerardo is in San Antonio, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Gerardo, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Howdy, amigos. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Happy to, Gerardo.
In some verses of the Bible, Jimmy, Jesus is saying that if anyone wants to follow him, to take his cross. Mm-hmm. Assuming that he said that before he was crucified and resurrected, wouldn't that phrase, take your cross, would be something that not everybody understood? It's kind of strange. Hey, take your cross. Wait a minute, I'm not a criminal. Mm-hmm. What do you think they thought about it? And also, well, I have another question, but first this one.
Okay, so Jesus said a lot of things people didn't understand, especially before the resurrection. A lot of what Jesus said only made sense in hindsight. And so when Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me, they probably didn't understand what he was saying. Now, they could get the sense of, okay, this is some kind of parable. We're supposed to be like Jesus. And he's gonna somehow take up a cross, but they probably don't know what that means. But they do know that crosses are instruments of death. And so at a minimum, the idea of taking up your cross is gonna mean being willing to embrace a life of suffering or persecution or something like that. And they could have speculated about what it would have meant, but they probably didn't understand it fully until they saw the example of Jesus and his crucifixion, and then that would help them figure it out more. But one of the things we definitely get the message from the Gospels is they did not always understand what Jesus was saying at the time. It took additional perspective and watching what ultimately happened to him for them to fully understand everything he said.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Jimmy. And the other one is about what you said about imprimatur and Neil mm-hmm. Ostad. I'm starting to write a book about the history of the Catholic Church, but in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And I was hearing your answer about imprimatur and Neil Ostad, and I was like, do I need an imprimatur or a Neil Ostad? But Catholic Answers books, they don't have imprimatur of Neil Ostad. When do I need or should I need an imprimatur or a Neil Ostad for my book?
Well, there are certain types of books that require an imprimatur. Like if you're doing a book of the Bible, if you're translating scripture, well, you need an imprimatur for that, and it actually has to come from the National Conference of Catholic Bishops or whatever the local bishops' conference is. Most books these days do not require an imprimatur. There are a few exceptions, like if you're doing a work of catechesis or if you're writing something to be a textbook, like to be used in a Catholic school, then you need an imprimatur on that. But if you're just writing an ordinary history, well, it's not a catechetical book. And unless you plan on having it being used as a textbook in a Catholic school, then you probably don't need an imprimatur on it. The full list of requirements for an imprimatur is actually found in the Code of Canon Law in the section on books. So if you go online, like they have the Code of Canon Law at the Vatican website, but if you go to the Vatican website and you look up the Code of Canon Law and you look up the section on books, it'll have the full description of it. But if you're just writing an ordinary history of the Catholic Church, then you probably don't need an imprimatur.
Gerardo, thank you very much. Appreciate the call. The number here is 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and there are two lines open. That almost never happens when Jimmy's here. If you've got a question you'd like to ask, go ahead and dial, and we'll get you in. We'll get you at least in the line and do our very best to get you on the air with Jimmy. Jimmy Akin, of course, is the podcaster behind Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and the Jimmy Akin Podcast. You also see him on lots of other podcasts. His books include The Bible is a Catholic Book and the Fathers Know Best, Teaching with Authority, and A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, you have a question about philosophy, you have a question about theology, all welcome. But the other category Jimmy's pretty happy with is anything else. So pick up that phone and dial if you've got a question, 888-318-7884. I will invite you again. Take a look at CatholicAnswersConference.com if you have any interest in coming to see Chris Stefanik and Father Jeff Kirby and Dr. David Anders and Steve Dawson and Jimmy Akin and all the apologists here. We got a big conference coming up September 25th to 28th, and we'd love it if you were there. Use the promo code EARLY if you sign up and save $50 on your ticket at CatholicAnswersConference.com. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin Podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin Podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Luca running the soundboard and rocking out to the groovy music. It is Friday, groovy music, and Jimmy Akin go together on Fridays here, and it makes for a lot of fun, and it's a nice opportunity for you to get in if you'd like to talk with Jimmy. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Going to Irwin in New Jersey, watching on YouTube. Irwin, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
How you doing, Jimmy? I'm going to ask you about a certain question. So about a year ago, my brother, he's a non-denominational Christian, and what happened is he asked me about the Catholic faith because I was converting to Catholicism, currently in the RCA program, and probably going to be confirmed this Easter.
Congratulations.
So my question is basically, thank you. He did ask, so my question is, when he asked me, like, you don't need to attend to church, and it's in Scripture. And he did tell me a verse. It's been a year, so I don't remember the verse in particular. But if I recall, it said something about, like, early Christians would go to their houses and pray to God, and it was not necessary for them to go to church. Now, I want you, if you can just help me kind of understand the first that he's talking about, and second, like, what's a way I can talk to him about it so that I'm able to let him know that it's actually necessary for us to go to church.
Okay, well, I wouldn't be able to comment on what verse he used to argue this, not knowing what that verse was. If you can find out that verse from him and let me know, I could comment on it. But what I can do in the interim is comment on the general principle, because it sounds like he may have been appealing to one of numerous verses in the in the New Testament that mentions Christians meeting in house churches. Now, the reason for this was that it was comparatively uncommon for an entire congregation of, let's say, a synagogue to convert to Christianity altogether. It was more common for individuals who, whether Jewish or, you know, Gentile, because there were Gentiles who attended synagogues, but they would tend to have individuals who became Christians, and they then needed a place to meet together. And if the local synagogue hadn't become Christian in a batch, well, then they probably didn't have access to the local synagogue. And same thing is going to be true of, oh, well, there's a pagan temple here and we got converts from the pagan temple, but not all of the people in the pagan temple became Christian either. And so what do you do in that situation? You need to meet somewhere. And so they would typically meet at the home of a wealthier member of the local Christian community who had a home big enough to have a meet-in in for a sizable group of Christians. And so, yeah, initially, while Christianity was just getting started and it didn't have many financial resources and so forth, they did tend to meet in house churches. But that's still going to church. It doesn't matter whether the church you're going to is in a house or something else. In fact, as Christianity grew and got additional resources, they very quickly started building special church buildings for themselves. You know, we have church buildings from the second century and things like that, where, you know, it's like, oh, okay, we couldn't take our synagogue with us, but now that we got enough Christians to build a new building, we'll build ourselves our own version of a synagogue. We'll build what's now called a church building. But it's not the building that's important. It's the gathering with other Christians regularly that's important. And this is stressed in various places in Scripture. One of them is Hebrews 10:25, where the author of Hebrews is writing to his audience and he says, "Do not forsake the assembling of ourselves together, as is the custom of some." So we're not supposed to forsake that custom of assembling together as Christians. We're supposed to keep doing that. And that's going to church, whether you're meeting in a house or meeting in a special church hall that's devoted to just being a church, or whether you're renting space in a shopping mall. You know, it doesn't matter where, it's the action of getting together with other Christians for worship that's important. And we know that that was done on a weekly basis. Luke mentions in Acts that Christians were meeting. This is in Acts 20, verse 7. He mentions that the local Christians were meeting on the first day of the week. And St. Paul indicates the same thing in 1 Corinthians 16:2, where he says he's talking about taking up a collection for Jerusalem, and he says, on the first day of every week, each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with your income, saving it up. And so that way they won't have to take up collections when he comes to pick up the offering that they're building up. But notice, that is assuming they're meeting the first day of every week. And so that means that's when they're meeting. They're meeting on the first day of every week, or Sunday, the Lord's Day. And so between forsake not the assembling of yourselves together, and the passages that talk about Christians meeting on the Lord's Day. Yeah, we need to be going to church. It doesn't have to be in a church building. It could be in an open field. But, and there have been cases where Catholics were being persecuted, like in the, some of the penal periods in Ireland, when the British weren't letting them meet in churches, they'd meet in an open field. So, you know, there are situations like that, but it's getting together with Christians for corporate worship that's the important part.
Okay, Irvin?
Wow, that actually answered my question. Thank you so much. Just meaning to ask you, what verse was it with the early Christians going to synagogues that you referred to when I asked the question?
Well, so, I don't have a specific verse in mind. It was a regular habit of St. Paul, if you read the book of Acts, to go to the Jewish community first in whatever town he was visited in and preach in their synagogue first. And then only if they rejected him in the synagogue would he then turn to preaching in other parts of the town.
Irvin, I will leave that there. Lots of folks still to get to before the top of the hour, but thank you very much for the call. Jack's in Portland, Oregon, watching on Twitch. We're glad you're here. Jack, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right. First, I want to say, Jimmy, I look up to you very much, so it's an honor to be able to talk to you and ask you a question.
The honor's all mine.
Oh, thank you. I had a question about the idea of kind of holy suffering, or at least justified suffering for the sake of growth.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit of backstory is that like 5 months ago, I had a breakup with somebody who I thought was the person. I still think they are the person. I ask myself if the outlook currently looks, if we think of it entirely without some divine intervention, the outlook looks very bad. And so I think, what is the purpose of the suffering if I don't see any alternative future for me? Because I don't see myself becoming a priest, just a very faithful Catholic. And it's made me struggle and falter, and there's been days where I've missed my rosary and days where I've missed my Bible reading because I think, oh, what the heck? And so I'm wondering, how do you progress forward? Like, how do you find a justification for your suffering so that it might not seem as purposeless?
Well, you can't always find a purpose for suffering in this life. This is something the Catechism talks about. It says that, you know, God would not permit any evil unless he was going to bring about, you know, basically an equal or greater good out of that very evil, and whether the evil is sin or suffering. But we will only know the answers to why this particular suffering, or this, why did God allow this particular suffering, or why did God allow this particular sin. That's something we're going to have to wait till the next life to figure out when we see the big picture. And so the Catechism acknowledges we often can't figure out in this life why did God allow this specific evil. We know that he's got a reason. There's some greater good. We just can't always figure that out in this life. What I would say in regard to your situation, first of all, I'm very sorry that this happened. It is not uncommon. Everyone who puts themselves out, you know, trying to find someone to, you know, romantically to marry, people get hurt. And that's a normal part of the human experience. You know, there's even that famous rock song that Cy might know the artist, I'm blanking on it, but Love Hurts. You know, it's a part of the human experience, especially in cultures like ours that prioritize romantic marriage over other forms of marriage, where romance didn't really come into it. Love ultimately grows, and is meant to grow in marriages, but it's a love it's not romantic love. That's something that comes and goes in life. Oh, I'm told Love Hurts is by Nazareth. The what we can do is look at what's the purpose of the negative emotions that that we experience when we suffer a romantic loss that we didn't desire. And the purpose is the same as the negative emotions we experience with any kind of loss. It's, you know, whether it's, you know, let's say a loved one dies, or you lose a job, or someone steals all your money and you've lost all your money, or you've lost a romantic partner. All of these hurt, and they're all based on a common underlying principle, which is loss aversion. Humans are averse to loss. We really hate losing stuff. We hate losing stuff even more than we get excited by getting stuff. And the reason is because we grew up in an environment that was resource poor. We grew up in a situation of scarcity. And if you're in a situation of scarcity, it's more important to keep what you have than to get even more. Because if resources are scarce and you lose your resources, you're in a world of hurt. And so just for survival purposes, you need to at least keep what you had. And so since we grew up in an environment of scarcity, we are loss averse as a species. We really hate losing stuff. And so the purpose of those emotions is to motivate us to not lose stuff, to do whatever it takes to try to keep a hold of what we have. But we can't always do that. You know, people are going to die. We're not in control of other people's free will. And they might, before we've committed to a permanent relationship with someone, they might change their mind. You know, we might even get married to them and then they might change their mind. We can't control other people's free will. So it's understandable that we have loss aversion and that we feel these painful emotions that are meant to help us try to avoid losing things, but we ultimately aren't in control of those things. And that leads to another point, which is something you mentioned briefly. You thought that this former romantic partner was the one, and you said, I think you still think the person is the one. I would encourage you to not look at it that way. There is, unless God divinely reveals to you that there is one and only one person for you, there's probably not. There's probably lots of people you could marry. There may be people who would be out there who would be even better to marry. The idea that there's this one person, this soulmate that you got to find, that's just not true. For almost everybody, there are numerous romantic partners that would be perfectly, perfectly fine, and that would bring joy into your life as well as struggles. And that's going to be the case for everybody, because life and certainly marriage involves struggles. But there are numerous people for basically everybody that could be successful marriage partners. And so don't think about it in terms of, oh, I've ruined it with the one, or and now I'll never find it. There's no one equivalent to this person. No, there are. There's lots of them. Don't limit yourself that way. So, you know, and that of itself, I think, will help recontextualize the loss in a way that makes it not as painful to realize, okay, it didn't work out with this person this time, and that was sad. But there are other fish in the sea, as they say, and you can be happy with someone else. And if you keep trying and you get back in the game, you will be.
Jack, I hope all that is helpful to you. We have to take a break now, but thank you very much for the call. More Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin coming right up.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
That retreat absolutely lit me on fire. Your talks and the spiritual counseling, I just want to learn so much about it. And as a parent of three boys, what can I research to continue that fire to impart that on my boys?
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Timmy Akin's our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. Still folks on the line. So we're going to go back to the phones and get as many on as we can. Duncan's right out here in California with us and watching on YouTube. Duncan, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. So thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just curious why St. Irenaeus in Against Heresies says that the church was founded and organized at Rome by Peter and Paul.
Well, it was.
But, I mean, it wasn't. Was it founded in Rome, though? Like, was it in Jerusalem or something?
Oh.
Well, no. When Irenaeus says that Peter and Paul founded the church in Rome, he means they founded the Church of Rome. In the two of them founded the church that is in Rome. The original.
Oh, okay.
Mother Church is in Jerusalem, but then after that was founded, the apostles began, you know, just like Jesus tells them in the book of, at the beginning of the book of Acts, it's going to be your job to be my witnesses in Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. And so after Pentecost in Jerusalem, the Christian circle of influence starts expanding outward from Jerusalem, and eventually it reaches Rome. And Peter and Paul were both apostles who ministered in the church in Rome and helped organize it there. They helped build it. Now, I should say that when he says they founded it, it's kind of got to understand that with a little bit of nuance, because we have evidence that Christianity would have been in Rome long before Peter got there. On the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, which is occurring in AD 33, Luke mentions there are Jewish travelers from Rome who were there at Pentecost who became Christian. And so they would have taken their Christian faith back to Rome with them when the holiday was over and they went back to Rome. So there was already a Christian community in Rome before Peter got there. Peter didn't get there until about 10 years later. He leaves Jerusalem in Acts chapter 12. And then Paul didn't get there till even later, and there was clearly a Christian community there. In fact, Paul wrote the letter to the Romans before he ever went to Rome. So there were already Christians in Rome before Paul ever got there. So Peter and Paul didn't found the church in that sense. They, in the sense of starting it from nothing, you could say they founded it in the sense of they put it on a firm foundation, a firm basis. They helped build it up and organize it and grow it and things like that. But, and so that's why they're often regarded as the co-founders of the Church of Rome. But you got to understand this concept of foundation doesn't mean started from nothing.
I'm going to leave it there because I want to try to get everybody on. But thank you very much for the question, Duncan. Let's go to James in Stephenville, Texas, watching on YouTube. James, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, Jimmy. I'm driving right now. My question would be the canon law 1247 pertaining to servile work, or not pertaining to servile work, but worshiping God on Sunday, and whenever the, I guess, you could say the servile work comes into play, because I heard that in we used to uphold that law. And my
what canon number did you say?
1247.
Okay. And your question is?
My question is, I'm kind of a little bit confused on it. Could you help explain to me and what, because I believe it was previously containing pertaining to servile work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so servile is an adjective that means what a servant would do, and or what a slave would do, because back in the day, servants and slaves were the same thing. It used to be the case that canon law prohibited quote unquote servile work on Sundays and other holy days of obligation. And so it would prohibit the kind of work that that servants or slaves would do, which would typically, or serfs, which would be stuff like you shouldn't be working in the fields and you shouldn't be, you know, building houses and stuff like that. You shouldn't be doing intense physical activity. Whereas clerical work, the kind of work that was, let's say, paperwork or administrative, well, that wasn't viewed in the as being in the same category. That wasn't hard physical work. And so you could do work like, you know, bookkeeping and counting money and stuff like that on a Sunday. But this ultimately was perceived as not really getting at the issue. And so the church dropped this, and there is nothing at all about servile work in the church's law today. If you're trying to analyze what is permitted or not permitted on a Sunday based on the concept of servile work, reach into your brain, grab hold of the concept of servile work, and rip it out, because it is not what it is not really getting at the underlying issue. The kind of work that servants do is not the important thing here. According to Canon 1247, which you very correctly identified as the relevant canon here, it says on Sundays and other holy days of obligation, the faithful are obliged to participate in the Mass. Moreover, they are to abstain from those works and affairs which hinder the worship to be rendered to God, the joy proper to the Lord's day, or the suitable relaxation of mind and body. So forget about servile work and ask, will this thing I'm contemplating doing on a Sunday, will that hinder me from worshiping God? You know, will it stop me from going to Mass or whatever? Well, if no, then it clears the first hurdle. Will it keep me from having the joy that's proper to the Lord's day? Am I going to hate doing this? And it's going to make me mad or sad on a Sunday? Well, if the answer is no, then you can do it. Or the suitable relaxation of mind and body. Is it going to stop me from relaxing in my mind or my body in an appropriate way? Notice none of those things have anything to do directly with the level of physical activity. In fact, if someone is like an office worker today, if they spend all of their time, you know, say writing computer code, well, okay, in the old days they would have been totally permitted to do that if they had computers. They would have been totally permitted to do that on a Sunday because it wasn't servile work. But if you spend all day every week writing computer code, you're going to get in a rut. And actually going out and mowing the grass, that'll get you some physical activity that can shake you out of the rut. And actually doing something like mowing the grass, you know, on a Sunday, that shaking you out of your rut can actually help you have suitable relaxation of mind and body. So, you know, if you mow the lawn every day, if you're a yard care person, well, then it would not shake you out of your rut to mow the lawn on Sunday. But if you're an office worker, it would. So the key is just, will a proposed course prevent you from one of those three goals I just went through? If the answer is no, you can do it on Sunday.
Oh, thank you so much, James, for the question. Jim in Vancouver, we'll be back to do this again next week. So sorry we didn't quite get to you, but give us a call next week. Jimmy Akin's been our guest. Check out the Jimmy Akin podcast. That's the newer of the two podcasts. Also, the long-standing podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hundreds of episodes now available. Check it out on mysterious.fm or wherever you get your podcasts. Jimmy, thank you very much. I'll see you next week.
My pleasure.
All right, that'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.